On today's episode, how to survive and thrive in all weather conditions with Andrew and Michael. Welcome to the Run Smarter podcast, the podcast helping you overcome your current and future running injuries by educating and transforming you into a healthier, stronger, smarter runner. If you're like me, running is life, but more often than not, injuries disrupt this lifestyle. And once you are injured, you're looking for answers and met with bad advice and conflicting messages circulating the running community. The world shouldn't be like this. You deserve to run injury-free and have access to the right information. That's why I've made it my mission to bring clarity and control to every runner. My name is Brody Sharp. I am a physiotherapist, a former chronic injury sufferer, and your podcast host. I am excited that you have found this podcast and by default become the Run Smarter Scholar. So let's work together to overcome your injury, restore your confidence, and start spreading the right information back into your running community. So let's begin today's lesson. It has been a long time coming getting Andrew and Michael on the podcast. If you're not familiar, they are the host of the Endurance Innovation podcast. I featured as a guest on their podcast a couple of months ago, probably October last year. And they kind of have a specialty in working in with heat transfer and surviving in the heat and how to cool yourself down effectively. And when I featured as a guest, they're like, look, anytime you want us on the podcast to talk about heat transfer, it'd be great. And I thought, is it what the audience wants? And so I asked my fellow patrons, and they were on board. About 60% of them were on board. And then I decided to up the ante or generate a little bit more value. So instead of just talking about hot and humid conditions, we're going to dive into all conditions. We're going to go through the cold, how to survive and thrive in frigid, cold, sub-zero, sub-freezing temperatures, and then work our way up to hot, humid. We're going to talk about dry versus humid, how that all matters. And the guys did a very good job of tackling all scenarios. And you can just see the passion. They do like to ramble on. And they did give me a bit of warning that they like to talk. And so that's why this episode is a little bit longer than what you might be used to. But nonetheless, as long as the value's there, I'm happy to let them keep talking. Before we dive into the interview, I wanted to try and do a bit of a campaign to see how many ratings and reviews I can get. So I've decided to, throughout these intros, to start reading them out because it seems like podcasts do that these days, and it does help. It doesn't help podcast rankings or featuring high or anything like that, but it is a good social proof that if someone were to find the podcast and then have a read through the reviews, it's just getting your feedback and your reactions and helping someone who is searching for a new running podcast, whether it is the podcast for them. And I always like hearing what your feedback is and what you just like your feedback on the podcast. And so ratings, leaving a rating and review is good for that. It's only if you are listening on Apple Podcasts, so if you have an iPhone. If you don't have one but have access to an iPhone, maybe a family or friend, that would also be a good way of leaving a rating and review and helping out the podcast. So you just go to Apple Podcasts, just in that search, just click the search function, type in Run Smarter Podcast, find it, scroll down, it'll say leave a rating and review, and then you can do that. You can press pause and do it now if you'd like, and I will be reading them out. Currently, I have 40 ratings and reviews, and I do hold myself to quite high standards. I want to try and double that within the next month or two, and I'll be reading them out here. So at the time of recording, like I said, we have 40, and there was one that came in just the other day from FineGal1, and she said, reliable information. Great podcast, interesting evidence-based information for runners. Thank you very much for leaving that. A while ago, there was a review, well, the second review I can see here, from Do A Little Dance, I like that name, and says, great tool to engage the mind with what's happening in the body. This is where running training should start, understanding your body and what it needs to succeed. Really enjoy Brody's enthusiasm and way of sharing information that is relevant to every runner. So thank you for leaving those. There are, I'm not going to go through all 40, but just an example. If you can leave a rating or review, that'd be fantastic. And I'll read it out on the podcast within the next coming weeks. And yeah, hopefully we can get to that ambitious goal of 80 reviews all up. Okay, let's dive in. I'll leave the links to the Endurance Innovation Podcast if you really like Andrew and Michael and love the science-y deep dive that they do. But a lot of runners are going to take away from this, whether you're in summer, whether you're in winter right now, no matter what part of the world you're in, we can all benefit from knowing how to survive and thrive in all weather conditions. So let's take it away. Andrew and Michael, welcome to the Run Smarter podcast. I have been following the Endurance Innovation podcast and like other episodes you guys have been on as guests, and the wealth of knowledge that you guys have is astounding. And I'm pumped to have you on to talk about all of, like, the temperature and temperature control. So guys, welcome to the Run Smarter podcast.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Brody. Yeah, it was. It's a pleasure to be on the show, to return the favor, because of course you were a fairly recent guest on our show.
Yeah, absolutely. I love returning favors and building us up and spreading the knowledge. Michael, let's start with you. How did you get involved? What's your background, and how did you build this interest around temperature control?
Well, so my education is in engineering. That's where my degree is, and it's mechanical engineering specifically. And for any of your listeners who've dabbled in that field or are in that field, they can appreciate the fact that thermal regulation and thermodynamics more broadly is a big piece of mechanical engineering, or it's one potential direction. And it was something that I always enjoyed in university, and it was something that I actually didn't suck at when I was in school. After graduating, I did some engineering related stuff, but then thought better of it and started coaching about 7.5 years ago. Thermal regulations is tangentially related to endurance performance, of course, especially in hotter climates. And Andrew and I started talking about this because of some ideas that he had that I'll let him talk about. And that is where kind of my educational background and the foundations that I understood of heat transfer from my engineering days came to be applied to endurance sport.
Cool. And what was your fitness background?
I'm an adult onset athlete. Didn't really do very much. Was not a very active kid at all through school or university. Started running just because some of my friends were doing it. When I picked up triathlon, which is, I suppose, my mainstay sport, almost 10 years ago, I realized how amazingly nerdy and deep that sport can be in terms of things to optimize and ways to train and any other rabbit hole you want to dive down. And it was kind of a natural fit for my engineering brain. So started doing triathlons in 2011 and have been ever since. A little bit less now that I have a couple of kids, but still pretty active and coaching triathletes and runners and cyclists is still my, I would say, mainstay gig.
Yeah, nice. And Andrew, what about you? How about you take it away?
Yeah, so my background is very similar to Michael's. So I did a mechanical engineering degree, and then I went on to do my master's. And then that was actually in combustion modeling. So it was numerical modeling. And then I decided that wasn't enough. So I'm going to spend the next 8+ years to do, or at least keep working on a PhD. I'm getting very close to submitting. Quick fun fact about that is I started, I think, the same year that the students who are coming into university now were born. Wow. I've basically been a student their entire lives, a post-secondary student. So my research topic, though, is aerodynamics and heat transfer, basically, so numerical modeling of that. But from the engineering standpoint, I love to look at the way the body acts, because I think as engineers, we have a ton to learn, but also as athletes, we have a bunch to learn from engineering, and we can leverage a lot of the lessons that we've learned elsewhere and just figure out how to control the condition that the body's in. And It just absolutely fascinates me how clever evolution has been with different ways to combat overheating. And it's just, yeah, an endless topic that I think as a whole, as a scientific community, we're only starting to scratch the surface of.
Great. So I guess we dive into the content. I wanted to structure it, have some sort of structure. So at the start of the podcast, I wanted to get into the colder climates. And then sort of as we talk about, as we ask the questions and gravitate towards the end of the episode, slowly just increase the temperature and then finish with like the hot climates at the end. So let's dive in. I think the most basic question we can start with is, let's just say we're at sub-zero temperatures and or like sub-freezing, you could call it if you're in Fahrenheit. But let's say we're leaving the house, we're dressed appropriately, and then we start our slow weekend run. And as the body starts warming up, what do we need to recognize? What do we need to consider? What is actually happening physiologically throughout the body? Who wants to start and kick us off?
Well, I actually have one question about being dressed appropriately, because I think when you leave the house, what you think is appropriate is different than 5 minutes into your run or 10 minutes into your run, because your body's not at a steady state temperature and condition at that point.
Very true. I guess you do have the luxury of taking off clothes while you are running.
True.
So
yes.
Perhaps when we're starting our run, we're not freezing cold, and we're not warm. I guess we're kind of staying, and we do have the luxury of taking off gloves, scarves, beanies, whatever. But when it comes to how the body is, like you say, regulating its temperature, physiologically, what's happening?
So the human body, and we'll get into this as part of answers to some of your follow-up questions, Brody, but the human body is amazingly good at generating heat when it's doing stuff. Running is one of the most kind of energetically demanding activities that we can engage in, more so than cycling, for example, that Andrew and I spend quite a bit of time talking about. So that means that all of that, you know, energy that the body needs to produce in order to propel us forward when we run, most of that is going to be generated as waste heat, right? So you do, you know, you generate the mechanical force to push off the ground to keep going. But a lot of that, the chemical energy that's used to generate that mechanical energy ends up being converted into heat. And that's just because we're not super efficient machines. We're pretty good, but we're not super efficient. I know on the bike, we're about 25% efficient, and that's where we have good data. And by that, I mean, you know, in cycling, you can get very precise in measuring. And I'm sorry to Brody's listeners if I use a lot of cycling examples, because that's where the science is a little bit clearer. But I'll stick to running, but I may jump to cycling for some examples.
Go for it. You have my permission.
Oh, thank you very much. So in cycling, you're about 25% efficient, which means that, let's say, if you're cycling at 250 watts, which for any of your cycling listeners is, you know, a pretty steady pace for a reasonably trained human on a bike, you're actually generating about 1,000 watts of total energy. So 750 watts, so 3/4 of that is being generated and just goes towards running your body and producing that power. So ultimately, that ends up as heat. And running is less efficient than cycling, I would wager to bet. And for any kind of running power, which is difficult to measure without lab equipment, you're probably producing quite a bit of heat. And so the reason I say all of this long nerdy preamble, is that your body's great at generating heat when it runs, right? So kind of the general advice that we give in sub-zero conditions is you want to be dressed so that when you walk outside, you're cold, if it's cold, because very quickly, and how quickly depends on how much heat you're generating and how cold it actually is, and certainly on some perception characteristics of the human, you're gonna warm up. And at that point, you're going to, if you overdressed when you left your house, you're going to want to be stripping layers, which is not ideal, because then you got to carry this stuff. So the kind of the general advice when you're leaving the house, and most people who run regularly in cold climates are well aware of this, is to underdress a little bit. kind of the biggest concerns with running in sub-zero, and we're Canadians are Celsius too, Brody. So you're good. We're speaking the same language here.
Great.
It's only the Americans, I think, that use Fahrenheit. So if you're sub-zero, if you're below freezing, the only thing you really got to worry about, and this is really when you're like well below freezing, in my opinion, is frostbite. And so frostbite, of course, is kind of what can happen to some of the extremities. So we're talking fingers, toes, tip of your nose, and other parts of your face, ears maybe, that are exposed, that in very cold temperatures. Because, of course, one of the things our body does when it's cold is it actually directs the flow of blood to and from different parts of the body. And when it's cold, it tries to conserve the blood towards the core where all the vital organs are, and of course the brain, which can lead to some of the extremities, again, those fingers, those toes, and those ears and noses, getting a little bit less blood flow. And if you get less blood flow, you're getting less of that thermal energy from the core, and the temperature for those parts of the body may drop, and that's where you can run into a little bit of trouble. This usually only happens for long runs and runs in very cold conditions, though.
And if we haven't dressed appropriately, or we're not warming up efficiently. Let's say it's like really, really cold. And would there be any warning signs, symptoms that the body is administering to know that we're not warming up efficiently or we're too cold?
Andrew, do you want to field this one? I only have an uneducated answer to this one.
I can speak from an engineering standpoint and some initial thoughts and concerns I'd have. So, One thing to consider, and this is no idea to predict if you're too cold, but just looking at it in terms of heat transfer, if, for example, you start sweating and say you strip off a layer of clothing, that would be at risk for swinging too far the other way, because it turns out that sweat is extremely efficient at removing heat from the body. So if it is cold, then or if it's too cold to be really having exposed skin, any sweat on there or any moisture, so say you spill some water or something like that, that will evaporate and drive down the skin temperature significantly, which can lead to local frostbite. So that would be a big concern. So I'd say be very cautious of any initial sweating conditions, especially if it's a longer run and you tend to overcook it at the start. And that may lead to, especially when you're far away from home, that may lead to some troubling conditions later on. But that's only from the engineering standpoint. I think for the physiology, maybe Michael, do you have something to weigh in there?
Yeah, I think I'm going to go back to what I said earlier, is that being that the human body is very good at generating thermal energy when it's in, you know, during active exercise like running. And I think you're not at risk for hypothermia. I can't imagine a scenario where, you know, you're out and you're running and it's so cold that the energy that your metabolism naturally generates when you're running is insufficient to keep you warm. I mean, I imagine that if you're so badly underdressed or that it's so cold that you just wouldn't want to be running in those conditions. Like, you just wouldn't be able to, you know, get out the door. You'd want to turn around right away. Certainly, I think the early signs would be, if there are any, is that kind of that pain and numbness in your extremities, like your toes and your fingers and your face, because that's a sign that your body is rerouting that blood flow, right? And the reason the body would do that is to conserve core temperature, right? Which is essential for, you know, well, for living. So if you're really starting to feel that hand numbness and pain, tingling in your fingers and toes and face, that may be a sign. If there is exposed skin, especially on the face, and there's a strong wind chill, you might actually get local frostbite on those exposed skin surfaces before you have any kind of, you know, again, risk of hypothermia. So bottom line is, I think the risk for hypothermia, if you're moving, certainly if you like run somewhere, or if you're doing a very long, let's say, trail run, and you get hurt or stuck, you're not moving, then there's a real risk. But if you continue to, you know, keep up your high output aerobic activity, I really don't think there's too much of a risk of hypothermia. The bigger risk is frostbite.
Yeah. One other risk that I would actually mention there is something, it's less of a long-term, or sorry, it's more of a long-term risk and less of an immediate risk, but I've noticed this with downhill skiing in the past. Because you're cold, you don't feel like you're getting much sun exposure, but if you're out and getting all this reflection off the snow and all this solar radiation, you can actually get sunburns. So it's something to be aware of if you are planning on spending a long time outdoors when it is sunny, but still quite cold.
Yeah, and goes back to the limiting. Just quickly chiming in here to let you scholars know, I have just updated my 5-day injury prevention challenge. This is one email per day for 5 days, learning new concepts and diving into the science on how you can reduce your risk of injury. The sign up link is in the show notes, so fill in your details and I'll be waiting for you in email number one tomorrow. The skin exposure as well, so that can come in handy. So it seems like what we don't want, which is what you alluded to, Andrew, before, is we don't want to get too warm and then swing the other way where we're exposing direct skin to such cold conditions, because that could potentially lead to more damage or a bigger swing in our body temperature, which we do want to be comfortable. And I know when it doesn't get like below zero here, but when it does get quite cold here in winter, and I have like a 1K block around my house, which I would start in like my hoodie, my tracksuit pants, and like lay it up, and I'll do like a 1K lap around my house and then take one layer off, do another lap around my house, take another layer off until I'm in shorts and t-shirt, and then I go for my usual long run. So if there's it could be like an option for someone who you know, wants to start comfortable with a lot of clothes and then doesn't want to have to carry a whole bunch of clothes once they're on their run. I found that very effective for me. But like I said, if you're in those really, really low temperatures, that sun exposure and then the wind chill and just direct skin exposure can put people in danger. So you might suggest, once you are warmed up, maybe like a thin layer of like, say, a long sleeve shirt, that so you're not having that direct skin exposure but still can maintain like the heat, something like that.
Yeah, we've talked a little bit about optimal layering for cold weather runs or cold weather activity of any sort. We're not really subject matter expert. Well, I'll speak myself. I'm not really a subject matter expert in this, but I have, you know, seen a bit of research and I've done a lot of practicing. I mean, it's probably minus 12 right now in outside. So you definitely want long sleeve, and you want the things next to your skin to be very efficient at wicking. So like, hydrophilic layers. So, polyester tends to be pretty good. That's generally what folks make base layers out of. So you want a wicking base layer that is long sleeve. And if it's cold enough, then you want to cover your legs, you know, obviously long leg as well. And you want it to be next to skin. And this is critical, because what the function of that layer is to provide some thermal insulation, but more than that, it's to wick away, remove that sweat that no matter what you will produce some of it as your body calibrates its temperature. So you don't want that sweat next to your skin. If it's going to evaporate, you don't want it to evaporate on your skin, as Andrew said, because if it evaporates on your skin, it's pulling thermal energy from the skin, which you don't want, which is what causes temperature drop and potentially frostbite. You want it to evaporate elsewhere. So this wicking base layer transports moisture from the skin to, you know, not the skin. And then depending on how cold it is, you probably want something to block the wind, because even if it's not necessarily super windy, and usually, at least in Canada, I don't know how it applies in other places, but probably is the same. But in Canada, our wind speeds are on average higher. So not only is it cold, but you have the wind to contend with. And so you want something that is windproof on top of that wicking layer to prevent, you know, to keep the wind off the skin. And then that garment should also be somewhat permeable to moisture, so that once your base layer pulls the moisture off your skin, the moisture can then evaporate through the wind blocking layer to the outside. It won't, you know, you'll still be sweaty and kind of wet, but it'll be way better than wearing a garbage bag. And then depending on how cold it is, you may want an insulating layer in between the two, in between the base layer and the outer layer. This is just some, you know, kind of layering 101 over here.
Yeah, I can see how you sort of gravitate towards the science of these things as well. You seem to get heavy into the nitty gritty.
It's fun. It's fun. One other thing I want to mention, and I forgot to mention it when I was talking about risks, and this isn't so much of a risk, but folks who have, especially asthmatics or people who have maybe a more sensitive upper respiratory system, can get some airway constriction in the cold. Now, this is an acute effect, so it's not anything that you're not freezing your lungs or your bronchial tubes. You're not really going to cause any permanent damage, but it's quite common to have cold weather exercise induced asthma, and it's more prevalent than like hot weather exercise induced asthma, which is also a thing. So it's something that if you do experience the symptoms of exercise induced asthma, if you have, you know, asthma outside of exercise, I don't need to say that you need to be careful running in the cold, but you may experience exacerbated symptoms of that asthma. So it's just something to be aware of. Wearing face covering tends to help a little bit, because the air that you inhale ends up being a little bit warmer than kind of free air. But, it's got its limitations too.
Okay, good to know. I do have some listener questions that I'll be throwing at you guys throughout this interview. And I'll start with my first one. And this is a question from Jill. She asks, I run in cold conditions, in brackets minus 28 Celsius. I'm dressed for it and have adapted to the cold and the wind. However, she's running much slower than summer speeds, no matter how warm my muscles get. Is this normal? And she also asks, how can I increase my performance in these conditions?
Well, I think there's a couple of things there. When I read this question, it took me a little bit of time to come up with some thoughts. But certainly everyone runs a little bit slower in the winter. And there could be a couple of causal factors here. So the first and most obvious, or maybe not super obvious, is the surface conditions, right? So if it's minus 28, it's quite likely that Jill is not running on bare tarmac. And if there's snow or ice underfoot, it's just like running on trails or running on sand or even worse. So those conditions will absolutely slow you down. And that's just straight up mechanics. You just don't have a solid surface to push against. And so that's going to slow you down. So the advice that I give to my folks when they're running on those kind of conditions is to use effort, or maybe even heart rate, rather than pace to guide your training prescriptions. Another thought is wearing all that extra clothing does a couple of things. It restricts motion a little bit. Like even if you're wearing quite, sports running specific, garments that are very stretchy and move with you very well. I at least personally find, and this is of course N=1 anecdotal stuff, but I personally find that if I'm wearing tights, my proprioception is affected. So I end up tripping a lot more, especially if I run on trails. So because my awareness of where my feet are is different because of this garment that's not normally covering my legs. So I don't know if there's much of a real efficiency hit that you take when you're wearing this stuff, but at least for me, psychologically, it feels harder to run in tights than to run in shorts.
Another point I'd make there too is the temperature of your shoes, and I hadn't thought of this until right now, but the temperature of your shoes might make quite a bit of a difference as well, because when rubber gets cold, you look at winter tires versus summer tires for cars, there's a significant difference in the rubber compound that's used, because it's basically designed to operate at lower temperatures. So the shoes themselves may lose a significant amount of efficiency. And I think everyone's kind of been made aware of how much shoes can contribute to efficiency by the Nike efforts recently with the Vaporfly and Alphafly. And there's a couple other factors there, but I think the energy recovery from the shoes would be another significant part of that.
Oh, that's a cool thought. I hadn't thought about that. That's awesome.
Yeah, me either. That was great. The other thing that I just thought of just then when you're talking about the wearing different layers. I do agree, like if you have several layers on compared to running in like a singlet and short shorts, you're going to be almost not restricted, but you're going to restrict your movements just because you can feel a lot of clothes on you.
Yeah.
And also the weight itself, like there has been studies to show that an increase of like every 100 grams your shoes weigh, that detrimentally affects your running economy. I think it's by like 1 or 2% for every 100 grams you put on your shoe. And granted, that's because the shoe's so far away from the actual origin, and it's got like the when you're looking at physics, it's like the very end of that vector. But if you've got like two layers on your legs, and you've got a couple of layers on your, like every little gram counts. And if you've packed on two or three layers, that's going to contribute to like detrimentally to some sort of economy, I would imagine.
Mm-hmm. I that was another point I was going to make, Brody. I totally agree with you. I think, you know, if it's very cold, like in Jill's example, -28, you could easily put on a kilogram worth of extra clothing over what you would wear in the summer. And especially if you're, you know, a smaller human, that kilogram can be a non-trivial percentage of your body weight, right? Like if you're, you know, if somebody who's a potentially like a small female who can weigh maybe 50 kilos, an extra kilo is 2% of added mass, right? 2% of mass is quite a bit, right? If you do the math. And I've seen similar studies that that show that extra weight absolutely affects running economy. And sure, when it's the greatest effect is when it's at the end of those pendulums, like your hands and your feet and your calves. But overall system mass does make a difference too.
Yeah. All right. Great point. We're going to move on to Lee's question. So Lee asks, he's noticed that his heart rate has increased in the cold when he does his workouts and he does his runs. He's asking why, and whether it's the clothes, whether the muscles are working harder. Can you guys pinpoint what might be the go here?
Yeah, I think it's very similar to my answer to Jill's question. If we're looking at, you know, what some training platforms will call efficiency, which is in running basically the ratio of your pace to your heart rate. That, you know, the higher your pace or the lower your heart rate, the higher your quote unquote efficiency is. It's not to be confused with economy. They're somewhat different concepts, obviously. But if you're wearing more layers and they weigh more and you're running on shoes, as Andrew correctly mentioned, that are no longer as nearly as springy as they would be otherwise, your running efficiency is going to be lower. That is, for the same heart rate, you're going to go slower, or conversely, for the same pace, you're going to have to produce more internal energy, thereby driving up your heart rate. So I think it's the same kind of mechanics. I guess this is a little bit of a conjecture on my part, but I imagine it's similar mechanics.
Yeah. Well, I do love when answers have this roundabout way of connecting, and we've got like similar concepts that are answering multiple questions. That's perfect as well. If we have these cold conditions, and let's just say we've laid up, and let's just say we don't have a lot of skin exposure, does the humidity, whether it's dry or humid, matter when it comes to performance and maintaining heat temperature? I know that we'll delve into dry and humid climates when we get into the hot climates, but when we talk about cold, we talk about sub-zero climates. Is there a difference?
Well, there's some really interesting stuff that goes on actually with air exchange specifically. So when you're breathing, the lungs are have evolved. You can tell I'm thinking of this like an engineer, but the lungs have evolved to have a tremendous amount of surface area, and that's for oxygen exchange. So basically the same thing that drives this gas exchange will also drive heat transfer. So as a byproduct or just a natural tie-in, or the heat transfer is quite high, and the mass transfer is high as well in the lungs. So if you have very dry air coming in, it actually warms up significantly and very quickly. So you might inhale air at a low temperature. So say it's minus 28. Once it brings up to body temperature, so let's say 35 degrees, for example, the relative humidity actually changes. So the absolute amount of moisture in the air initially would be the same. So you might have 1 gram of water per kilogram of air, for example. I can't remember the exact numbers. But air is capable of storing much more water when it's warm, which is why you get, in humid environments, you get glasses that will sweat. So if you can imagine opening like a cold beer or something on a warm, humid day, you often get this sweat on the outside that's just condensation. So when you get this air in your lungs that's now warm, it's capable of taking a lot of water out of your body. And even though you're not necessarily sweating, you're losing so much water from respiration. So it's actually a bit of a problem. And I think people will tend to underdrink when they're exercising in cold conditions. I know I do myself, because often you're cool and you don't feel like you want a drink, but you're actually dehydrating yourself pretty quickly. As to the difference between humid and dry air, I think it might be more on the external skin that it makes a difference. So you'll have sweat evaporate quicker. And you will sweat. Like Michael was saying earlier, you will sweat when it's a dry condition, but it will be wicked away much faster. But the actual amount of water that cold air can take with it, can transport, is quite a bit lower than when you're dealing with more room temperature conditions.
That's great. I love when I come up with these topics and I have guys like you on, you're coming up with answers that I would never, ever consider. So it's awesome that you guys are here to share this wisdom. But I want to move on to warmer conditions. So the next sort of category would just be ideal temperature, because even though like the vast majority of, say, races, they're in this ideal temperature, maybe 15, 20 degrees Celsius, something like that, but we still obviously need to avoid overheating. The body's still having these mechanisms and ways of, they've evolved to certain ways to maintain our body temperature. Let's just say we're doing a long race and we're in, say, 18 degrees. How is the body maintaining a temperature different to, say, the cold? Or like, what are some systems that we need to consider?
Go ahead, Andrew.
I wasn't sure if you wanted to answer this, but there are a few things that the body will do to maintain temperature. So like Michael was saying, if you're outputting 250 watts of mechanical energy, and however that gets output as a runner, you're generating, say, 750 watts, which is half of a pretty strong electric heater that you'd have in your room in the winter. So there's a lot of heat coming off your body, and your body always has to deal with this. And as soon as it starts to see temperatures elevate, there's this a couple natural coping mechanisms that will fire up. So you get this blood flow is pushed towards the skin, basically, because your body's trying to use your skin as a heat exchanger. It's trying to get rid of extra heat. Sweating will trigger, and you'll start to lose your hydration that way, but it's because the evaporation takes away so much energy from the body. So you're starting to do these two things already to try and maintain your temperature as soon as you get the slightest little bit of elevation. And it's often with people who are more heat acclimated that they will start to sweat sooner, because their body recognizes that this is the natural reaction, and it kind of knows what conditions are coming up. So I think it's even 18 degrees that you mentioned is, I would say, on the hot side for what the ideal temperatures for a fast race would be. And you often see marathoners preferring maybe 5 to 8 degrees Celsius, because their power output is so high that in order to maintain a very consistent body temperature and not overheat at the paces they run, they just need to have those cool conditions to drive the heat transfer and keep themselves at that stable temperature.
Very good. If you're finding someone in this climate is like, they're looking at their other running mates and they feel like they're struggling, they feel like they overheat quicker and they feel like they're sweating too much, and the other runners beside them seem to be very comfortable, are there things, are there strategies we can implement in order to help maintain and not feel as overheated?
How much time do you have, Brody?
you have 3 minutes to answer.
So yeah, there's definitely a few things we can do. One thing I'll echo what Andrew said, this is something that folks I think misinterpret when they're looking at themselves or others. Profuse sweating is an adaptation. So someone who sweats quite a bit, is a high volume sweater, is actually better adapted at heat transfer because of that. And Andrew didn't get into the thermodynamics of evaporative cooling, but it is tremendously effective. So without getting into the, you know, on our show we've thrown numbers at folks, but we'll spare you guys that. It's by far the overwhelmingly the most effective means of heat transfer. So when you sweat, provided, and this is a very big kind of caveat here, provided that sweat evaporates on your skin, similar to what we're talking about, where you don't want that to happen in the winter because you get frostbite, when you're trying to shed heat, this is a very, very efficient way to do so. So sweat evaporation is very efficient. So if you're a heavy sweater, that is not a sign of lack of fitness. If anything, that is a sign of solid aerobic fitness. In fact, one of the first adaptations to endurance training, especially endurance training in warm and hot conditions, is earlier onset sweating and higher volume sweating. So that's you know, a tick in your favor as an endurance athlete. With sweat, there are obviously some things that we need to worry about. Dehydration becomes a serious factor. So for longer races, that becomes an issue. But let me rewind. So to your question of strategies to help, there are some strategies in training, and then there are some strategies in actual execution of the race in question. So in training, there's some very good evidence to suggest that heat adaptation really does work. There are definitely varieties of heat adaptation protocols. But what's thought to be necessary by the folks that are much smarter than me is for individuals to spend, anywhere from 7 to 14 days adapting to the heat. And what that adaptation actually looks like is spending roughly an hour or more. It doesn't have to be every one of those 14 days, but let's say 5 or 6 out of the 7 days of the week at a core temperature of 38.5 or higher. So this is a little bit of a tricky thing to figure out unless you have a means of measuring your core temperature. But basically, it's you want to spend about an hour in an elevated thermal state. So when your body's like, oh, we're quite hot, we need to figure out how to shunt this heat. And during this time, you're probably quite uncomfortable. You're sweating profusely, provided you're not dehydrated. You know, you're still thinking clearly and stuff. But it's an obviously elevated temperature state. So if you follow any number of these protocols, that's kind of what you're looking for. You're looking for your body to be at that elevated core temperature for, you know, a non-trivial amount of time, about an hour, 5 or 6 days of the week, about 2 weeks. And again, there are a few of these protocols. There's a few ways to do this. You can go out there and you can train while removing some of the things that would normally cool you. So as an example, if you're running in the summer, you can wear extra layers. Super uncomfortable, pretty gross, but it'll definitely drive the body temperature up. Conversely, you can train during hot parts of the day, right? When it's, you know, let's say in the afternoon when it's sunny. With all of these, you have to be extremely careful, folks, because, you know, heat exhaustion and heat stroke are legitimate serious concerns. You know, certainly heat stroke is a medical emergency, and we've talked about this on our show, but even heat exhaustion is not your friend, because you don't want to push yourself to the point where you're in serious distress. Because not only is it incredibly uncomfortable and could potentially be dangerous, it also delays how quickly you'll recover from that session. So then you can really compromise your kind of big picture training. So you really want to be careful with thermal adaptation training. But one way to do it is to cover up when you're training. If you're doing indoor training, like if you're on a treadmill, for example, you may want to turn off the fan right? That's a very effective way to do it. Or again, layer up a little bit. And then some other interesting ways to do it would be train as normal. Oh, one thing I'll say about training while trying to drive core temperature up is you never want to do an intense session. These sessions should always be very, very easy in terms of your mechanical output. So for example, if you're running, you really want to be running at your, choose your intensity metric here. You're kind of your zone two or sub aerobic threshold, right? So if your listeners are familiar with that concept, you definitely want to be very, very easy. Easier than long run pace, I would say, is the way to do this, because you cannot be doing interval training while also trying to drive up core temperature. That's a recipe for not doing anything well and ending up as a very sad athlete. But the other way to do it is after a fairly intense session is you want to jump into a sauna or into a hot bath for, and again, durations vary, but for like a good 30 to 45 minutes, because the idea there is an intense training session is going to drive your body temperature up anyway. And then the hot sauna or hot bath is going to retain that temperature for, that extended period of time. So the research seems to suggest that it doesn't really matter how you get there, whether or not you're doing it while you're training. Driving your temperature up. Whether or not you do it through training or you do it through just hanging out in a hot environment, it's going to be effective. But what this protocol will do, or this approach will do, is a few things. It'll trigger that early onset sweating that I mentioned earlier. The other thing it'll do is it'll actually tend to drive up blood plasma volume, right, which is the liquid water content of your blood. And that's really useful, because when you're doing a hot race, for example, then as you start to dehydrate, because you're sweating quite a bit, you will have more of that margin before dehydration starts to affect performance.
Okay. You did not take 3 minutes, but I'll forgive you.
I have serious trouble keeping to my timetables.
When we're talking about adaptation, and the listeners will be very familiar, hopefully, because they've listened to the start of these podcast episodes and they know that episode one is adaptation education. When we're talking about, say, load on the body or just adapting as a runner, we know that we want to find this adaptation sweet spot where we're not underdoing it, where it doesn't trigger adaptation, but we're not overdoing it, where you just push the body, doing too much too soon leads to injury and breakdown rather than build up. When you're talking about training and adapting to heat, it sounds very similar, that we want to find this sweet spot. We want to heat up the body, maybe putting on some layers or training during hard times of the day, but we don't want to overdo it. We don't want to do intense sessions with like six layers of clothing, or we don't want to go out when it's like 30 degrees and try and run at really intense rates to try and adapt to heat. Because like you said, it might take longer to recover, but you might just put it into too much shock that it's not going to trigger adaptation anyway. Would that make sense? Mm-hmm.
Totally. I think you're absolutely spot on. So the way with, the way to approach this style of training would be similar to the way you would approach, any kind of run training, right? When we take a runner from couch to whatever, 5K, you start out with a run walk, right? So you start very, very gently. So until you establish a useful protocol for yourself and really figure out where your points are, where, how much can you tolerate, how quickly can you recover, it makes a lot of sense to do this kind of adaptation very gradually. So one possible route of doing this is if your race is, your race is going to be hot. So you're going to want to do a heat adaptation protocol kind of, 2 weeks out from that, because some of those, some of the benefits that I mentioned, like especially the increased blood plasma volume, it's not a, just like with anything else, it's not a forever positive adaptation. It will eventually fade. So you don't want to do your heat block too far away from your race. So one thing that you may want to try and do is do one well out, right? Just to experiment with what you can tolerate, and be very, very gradual with it and increase your thermal load very gradually. So what does that look like? I would still keep intensity very low, because that's the hallmark of pretty much every protocol I've ever seen. But you may want to increase the duration that you do some of these things. You may want to increase the time in your sauna or the time in that hot bath, or you may want to put more clothes on. If you want to get really scientific with it, Andrew and I have been really loving this this device out of Switzerland.
I knew this was going to come out.
You cannot bring it up. There's a device. This is a free plug for these guys. A device by a Swiss company called Core Body Temperature Sensor, which is a little sensor. It's like the size of your heart rate monitor chip. You wear it on the side of your heart rate monitor on the side of your chest, and it tells you quite accurately your core body temperature. And with that, you can really get very specific and very accurate core temperature readings. And then you can really design thermal stress training appropriately. But without that device, you can you really do want to err on the side of less rather than more, because Brody, you're spot on. I couldn't agree more with you. You can really easily overdo it, especially with thermal training, and the benefits will not at all be worth it.
And yeah, it's just such an interesting thing to see too, because we've never had this, at least at the athlete level. Maybe at the lab level they've had this insight, but for the average person who's training, the only real ways to measure your core body temperature were either an ingestible pill, which is extremely expensive and for obvious reasons a one-time use, or a rectal thermometer, which again, the average athlete is probably not going to be looking at using this for a training session. So this has just been, it's been a game changer for me. And just, it's super interesting, both in training and, Michael, you've been wearing it outside of training too, just to see the normal circadian rhythm.
Very interesting. Yeah. That's awesome. One thing I love, go on.
Oh, no, I just wanted to, like, very quickly, this is the second part of your question about what are some of the strategies. So within the race, and I won't spend too much time talking about this, but there's a few really important ones. Obviously, drinking sufficiently, but not too much to slow dehydration. You're going to dehydrate during a race. It's impossible to replenish all of the fluids lost. And I'm sure you've had folks talk about hydration, and I'm not an expert, and this isn't what we're talking about here. But replenishing as much as it's safe to do for your body, that's important. But there are also some really interesting strategies around ingestion of ice and ice slushies that are incredibly useful at bringing core temperature down. And that's because, similar to when water evaporates, it takes a lot of heat away from your body if it evaporates off your skin. This other phase change from a solid ice to a liquid water is also very energy intensive. And so if you ingest ice, whether it's just you're just sucking on it in your mouth, or you're actually able to get it into your GI tract through a slushie, then you are actually going to be able to shed quite a bit of heat in melting that ice inside your kind of your body. Can we say control volume on the show, Andrew?
I think it might be a dangerous term to get into.
Okay. Yeah. In your body control volume.
one quick note on that is I ran a couple calculations actually before we got on here, just to have an example. So sweat is still much more efficient. So when you're evaporating something, it's very, very efficient at removing heat. So for example, 1 liter of sweat for myself, so I weigh about 78 kilograms, 1 liter of sweat will cool my body down the equivalent of 6.5 degrees Celsius, or it would prevent that increase. And that's if it goes 100% to evaporation. A slushie would be about 1.5 to 2 degrees Celsius if it's, again, fully absorbed by the body. And when you consider that a normal resting core body temperature is around 37.5 degrees Celsius, and the limit for hyperthermia or heat stroke is 39.5, that 2 degrees is really the difference between being normal and comfortable and being at the verge of a medical emergency. And as we started this podcast, I'd actually just gotten off the bike. So I had a pretty intense bike workout and I got a smoothie. And I'm now sitting here shivering because I just had essentially a slushie and I brought my core body temperature down quite a bit.
It's a good strategy. I'm not too sure how, like, based on training, I don't know how many people have access to it during a marathon per se, but it's really cool to know that just strategies like that can drastically drop that body temperature. And looking back on my training, say if I was running compared to cycling, and you're talking about how effective evaporation can be, particularly on the skin, and I look back on my training sessions, I hardly ever overheat on the bike, and I hardly, let's just say, I don't necessarily go on a bike ride during the middle of the day on a 30-degree day, but if I was, say, cycling every morning, even if it's in winter and I'm cycling for 2 hours, I never get warm. It's like I'm cold the entire time, no matter how hard of a bike ride I go on. But then as soon as I'm indoors and I have like an indoor training session, I'm just sweating and overheating straight away. So I guess just based on my own experiences and my own self-reflections on the benefits or how the body adapts to core body temperature, I think the sweat and evaporation, like just in those examples there, just has a tremendous effect. And then you're talking about cooling strategies, so cooling things down. I don't think a lot of people would be able to drink a liter of slushy like just in one go. Is that recommended?
I think brain freeze would be an issue.
Yeah. Also, it's not, just from ingestion of fluids, you wouldn't want to chug a liter of any kind of fluid or, fluid, solid, slurry, just because of what kind of GI distress that would cause. But the point is, you don't have to do it all at once. You're absolutely right too, Brody. In a marathon, you're not going to get this, but you may get ice, right? So in hotter events, I know definitely in triathlons, you will have access to ice. So one of the strategies is to pop one in your mouth, because as long as it melts inside your body, right? Whether it's in your GI tract or in your mouth, it's going to have some positive effect. Even if you just hold it in your hands and you kind of close your hands around the ice cubes, sort of make a loose fist, and that ice melts in your hand, it's not going to be as effective as if you'd swallowed it, but it's still going to transfer quite a bit of ice. Quite a bit of thermal energy away from your skin and from your body.
Yeah, good to know. What I've liked about this as well is you're also answering a lot of the future questions I also have. So I was happy for you to ramble on and keep talking, because I now have to ask less questions. But we're delving into now the hot climates and how we can thrive in here, which you've pretty much already discussed. We can train for adaptation. And one of the questions was from Lee, and Lee said that they had a nightmare half marathon in 31 degrees Celsius, was going at race pace, and then the heat caught up with Lee, and was wondering, should we, in these hot conditions, should we be running to heart rate to better manage our effort or energy output, or can we still train or I guess adapt to the heat and then still do a race pace based on speed?
So no, that's a very easy answer, is that in 31 Celsius, that would be considered an extreme kind of conditions, even if it's quite dry. And I notice you have a question about humidity, which is super relevant too, but even if it's quite dry, 31 Celsius is very hot. And if it's dry, you will still have access to the evaporative cooling. In fact, it'll probably be very effective. Like if it was 31 in the desert somewhere, in the outback for you guys, you would have evaporation as a very, very useful form of heat transfer. But there is no way of getting around the fact that you're not going to perform at your best at 31 Celsius as compared to what Andrew was saying at the optimal temperature between 5 and 10 degrees Celsius, which is kind of generally touted as the best marathon temperature. Now, normal, so if Lee trains at 31 degrees all the time, and 31 degrees is normal, and whatever Lee's race pace at his normal 31 degrees, if he's racing in those conditions, then that's his normal. But then, of course, I imagine that's not what they had in mind. But also then, if that was Lee's normal, then if they ran at, 10 degrees Celsius, they could go a lot faster.
Yeah. And I can share a very similar experience as well. I was training for a half marathon a couple of years ago in Melbourne in winter. And I went to travel around in Europe and had a couple of half marathons booked there. And one of my half marathons was in Amsterdam. And so I was traveling around Europe for maybe a week before doing one of those half marathons. And I trained in winter in Melbourne. which would have got to around maybe between 10 and 12 degrees is what I was used to running in. Then went to do this half marathon in Amsterdam, and it was probably about 17 degrees, so not hot, maybe about 18, but I struggled so much. Like, it got past the point of me just struggling, and I started getting like a headache, I started to feel like really sick and lightheaded, started to feel sick in my stomach, and I just had to walk for like the second half. I just could not do anything. Based on those symptoms, do you think I just hadn't adapted to the heat? Because I only just realized later, maybe the next day, that maybe I just hadn't adapted to the heat. I didn't think about it during the race. Would that make sense for you guys?
So I asked you before we started the show, Brody, if I could curse on this podcast, so I'm going to do it here and say that physics is a bitch. So there is some adaptation that you can do, but heat transfer is heat transfer is heat transfer. So if you push your body past a certain set point, and it's different for different people, and you can probably train it a little bit, and this is more psychological than physiological. So you can probably train to tolerate a higher core temperature and not you know, get totally washed out like you did, and still be able to perform. There are dangers with that, because there's like some chemical processes that just don't work very well at above our kind of optimal temperature. And then that's when you get into heat strokes and like hospitals. And there are people, it's really hard to drive yourself there, but there are people who are known to have this ability and often end up in those tents because they can just push themselves beyond this set point. So that set point is real. So in terms of adaptation, maybe if you'd been more, psychologically adapted, you could have pushed a little bit further. And if you'd been more physiologically adapted, maybe you would have had slightly higher blood volume. Maybe you would have started sweating earlier. And you probably would have had a little bit more. But if you're talking about this effect happening halfway through the race, I don't think there's anything you could have done in your training that would have allowed you to run at that pace in those conditions for the half marathon, right? So then the only real answer would have been that under those conditions, the smart thing to do would have been to slow down, right? Run into a 7-Eleven en route and get a big gulp and chug that down, right? Unless you had some kind of active cooling strategy, I don't think that there's a way that you could have done that race at the pace that you set out to do.
It's a little bit tougher for long races, but you do see athletes occasionally pre-cooling themselves with ice vests, or if you have something before the race, like a cool drink, the slushy, that will at least kind of buffer you for that heat, the temperature increase, so that you're at least offsetting. So it'll be longer before you hit that critical point and have to slow down. But it is a really tough one. And there's been good research to show that highly trained athletes maybe, like to the pro level, maybe have more tolerance to this. And there's one study in particular I'm thinking of. It was done for time trial cyclists in Qatar in 2016. And this study actually showed that, first of all, people are able, in terms of core body temperature, are able to go much higher than previously expected. So I think some athletes were reaching 41.5 Celsius, which is basically, if you were to take that measurement in a hospital normally, someone would be basically at the verge of being, well, at death's doorstep. But with these athletes, yes, they were hot at the end of the race, but they were able to psychologically tolerate it as well as physiologically tolerate it. Now, there's a difference too between the brain temperature being 41.5 and the core temperature being 41.5. But there is some evidence that different people may react differently to this.
Okay. Well, it makes me feel better, because I was definitely beating myself up and extremely disappointed when I had to walk for a second half of a half marathon. But makes me feel better. Let's delve into humidity, because Aaron asks, how can we cool down in these humid conditions? And is there a point where it's just too much to run outside? But let's break this into the components. So if it is hot and if it is very humid, is there any strategies we can do to cool down?
So cooling, as we've mentioned many times, happens mostly through evaporation. There's some convection, so basically like having wind go over you. But hot air going over you is only slightly more comfortable than just being in still hot air. So And I've actually done a laboratory study. It was for cycling, but it was in a humidity chamber. So it was like 80% humidity and 31 Celsius. And it was 45 minutes at for cycling at about 75% of my threshold power, which is pretty uncomfortable by the end of it. And under these conditions, you're basically storing all of the heat. There's no real way to get rid of it. You're not convecting it away. You're not evaporating it away. So when you are in these hot conditions, there's only so much you can actually do. So if it's nice and breezy, it can remove a little bit of heat, but really maintaining that body temperature with any means possible, that's really what I'd recommend doing. So if you can have access to ice and slushies, and I think even it wasn't this discussion, but the previous discussion that we had, I think it was when you were on our podcast, Brody, we had talked about cooling your wrists down. If you can put ice directly on your wrists, this is actually an adaptation that I believe kangaroos have developed, where they would lick their inner arms because the evaporation there, there's a lot of blood flow going through your wrist, and that basically takes it right back to your core. So if you can apply ice to that, it's a very effective way to lower your core temperature. But there's only so much you can do in these hot, humid conditions. And I think of something like Hawaii, where the Ironman World Championships are held most years, except this year. But it's an extremely challenging place to race, and it really tests people's ability or their body's ability to manage their heat.
So we should be like accepting the limitations of the human body. And if you are stuck in a hot, humid condition, maybe just like be sensible and take your fluids and just drop your intensity, and, you know, don't try and compete at a race where you might be like at a race pace where it is cold conditions. Would that be right?
Yeah. I think there's definitely some concessions that you have to make. One other thing that we haven't touched on yet that just popped to mind is we've also talked in the past, Michael and I have talked about different clothing. There's wicking and things like that to consider, but there's another big part. If you have the sun beating down on you, if you're wearing a non-reflective piece of clothing, then you're absorbing all that solar radiation, and that can actually increase your body temperature quite a bit. And I think the calculations I'd done before were saying that a cyclist can pick up approximately another 200 watts of solar radiation, which is not an insignificant amount to add to their thermal load. So if you can essentially reflect that away instead of absorbing it, that can help you, especially when you're just at that tipping point where it's just too much heat, that can help you from reaching that overheating level.
So are we talking about lighter colors that can reflect light, or are we talking different components of the clothing itself?
Lighter colors for sure. So if you can keep the sun off of your skin, that's ideal. So there might be some cases where, and I've seen these before for cyclists where they have arm coolers, but basically when they're white, even though you're wearing that extra layer, it reflects away the radiation or the temperature, the energy that would otherwise be absorbed by your skin. So I've never tried them. I don't know how effective they feel. They're also supposed to help with evaporation too, but just if you can prevent that energy from ever getting to your skin, that's definitely a benefit.
Yeah,
great. Yeah, to Aaron's question, I think that's the only thing you can do is if it's super humid. I agree with what you guys said. Is really the only thing you can do is go slower or don't go at all if it's very, very humid and hot. But if it's not a race, if it's training, then certainly training outside of daylight hours is an advantage. I remember spending some time in Singapore where it was, you know, always 30 degrees and 100% humidity every single day. And I was trying to run there, and it took a little bit of time for my body to like get used to it, but I could only run after sunset because those extra, you know, 200 watts that Andrew mentioned, well, that's peak, probably noon heat flux, but it definitely helped. The other thing with, I'll add to Andrew's point, is the psychological component. So we feel a lot of that of that heat on our skin, right? So what you felt was definitely a systemic effect when you during that half marathon, Brody, when you felt sick to your stomach and you were lightheaded. But generally, we feel hot or cold on our skin because that's where the temperature sensors are. The nerve components are in the skin. So when you have direct sunlight on the skin, it feels quite hot because you're directly feeling that solar radiation. And covering that up with clothing or, you know, running or training when there is no sun, or at least it's cloudy, removes that psychological input telling your body that it's hot. So there's definitely a physiological component of that extra 200 watts, but also a psychological one too.
Okay, Michael, I'm gonna really test you with this next one. Are you ready? Because I'm going to give you one sentence to answer this question. Because Aaron, in the second
component, could it be a run-on sentence?
The second component is like, is there a point when it's too much? Like if the humidity and the temperature is too much to run outside, what's your one sentence answer for that?
Yes. You can probably imagine a point where it's too much. I think most people can, provided you can slow down and you're not doing very long runs, you can run in most conditions. Yes, most conditions, but probably not all.
Cool. Very good. I've got one last listener question and I'm curious to hear your guys' thoughts, because it's sparked my curiosity. Steve asks, in some cultures, having hot drinks to cool down is counterintuitive, but it's meant to cool down the body. What about for athletes? Does temperature of the drink matter? Now, we've already talked about the slushy stuff and how it does cool down the body's core temperature quite significantly. Anything we can add? Has there been any investigations into having hot drinks to try and cool us down?
So my assumption, and this is not based on any direct science that I can reference at this point, and Michael, feel free to please correct me or stop me if I'm saying something inaccurate. But
nope, I've never seen research on this either, Andrew. Go ahead.
my complete conjecture would be if you drink something hot, it may trigger you to sweat. And that sweating would then lead to a larger net reduction in temperature than the energy essentially that you're bringing into your body or with that fluid. So that would be my best guess as to why that would happen.
That's my guess as well. That was the only thing that I could come up with too.
Yeah, cool. And I guess we're not drawing from evidence. I think there might just be, I might have to reach out to Steve, but it seems like there might be some cultures that have hot drinks without being any scientific explanation. But yeah, good to know. Guys, anything that we haven't touched on, specifically around the heat, any like kind of final tips or tricks that we haven't talked about on how someone can survive and thrive within these hot conditions?
A couple of final points, and this is just to tack on to what I was saying earlier about heat adaptation training, is you want to be very careful with how you do it. So for the most part in training, I would encourage folks to train during, you know, moderately not hot periods of the day or conditions, especially if you're trying to do quality work like intervals or tempo or any kind of race pacey stuff, in order to get that quality work in, and saving the heat adaptation stuff strictly for heat adaptation, not trying to, you know, kill two birds with one stone here. But it is important to be both physiologically and psychologically prepared for it. So if you know that your event has potential to be hot, and the perfect example is the maybe upcoming Tokyo Olympics, where all the national federations are really working hard to adapt their athletes to the heat because the games are expected to be very, very warm. So if you go into an event, and again, Brody, your example was the best one, where you came from a 10 degree environment to an 18 degree environment, which is not a huge swing, and you suffered seriously. If you are training in a cool environment, which happens to us Canadians all the time, because, you know, it's cold in Canada and in the winter. And there are lots of early season triathlons in the southern US, for example. And people like to do those races because they're tired of being cold and snowy and dark up here. So they'll train indoors and they'll run outside and then they'll go to Texas and they will die because it's they've gone from, you know, 0 degrees to 20 degrees and they just cannot perform. So you have to spend some time adapting to it in order to perform.
You just triggered another thought there for me, Michael. But talking about the Tokyo Olympics, one of the guests that we had interviewed on our podcast, Erica Gavel, she had done some research on actually using a menthol rinse to basically convince your body that you're cooler, which was shown to improve performance. So this is more for short events where it's not the steady state temperature that you're fighting, but short intense events, like having this perception of being cooler at the start of it can actually help.
Very cool. Yeah. And some really nice tips. And I think we summed that up really nicely. Guys, the Endurance Innovation Podcast, if someone wants to know more about it, or if they're not sure what it is, can you just give us a brief summary of the nature of it, whose its intent is for, and where they can go to find it?
Well, I think we could probably start by saying, if you're not already scared off by our discussion here and going into the scientific details, that's something, this is a regular departure for us. And we absolutely love nerding out over heat transfer and aerodynamics. And then there's a lot of other things that we've been talking about recently too, with, we've got a couple upcoming shows that, depending on when this episode gets released, have been talking about, using AI to help guide your training schedule. So I think this is pretty typical of an episode that we'd see.
Yeah. So, okay, Brody, thank you very much for the plug. It's available on pretty much all of the podcast aggregators. So your Apple Podcasts and Spotify's, and Deezer's and all of them, iHeartRadio, we're on all of those. And if you just look for Endurance Innovation, you'll find us there. We, on social media too, I'll post episodes with some regularity because social media, I really like heat transfer and aerodynamics, but social media is not always my friend. But, my own coaching account is X3 Training on Instagram. And I will usually post when a new episode drops, but certainly the best way to follow us is just to subscribe, to the podcast feed. We release, weekly. And it's two mechanical engineers talking about endurance sports with some really smart guests from time to time. So I do encourage your listeners, if they're interested in this kind of nerdy banter, to tune into that show.
Yeah, and I'll include all those links in the show notes, and I'll also include one of your podcast episodes. I think it's like really early days. It's called "It's Getting Hot in Here." So if people are interested. Yes. And want to delve deeper, and like I said, if you're focused on the numbers, you're getting into the nitty-gritty and the science heavy topics discussions, then that's a great episode for you to delve straight into. So I'll include that in the show notes. Andrew and Michael, you guys are a fantastic team. I can see you guys feed off each other very well, and once one person's talking, the other it sparks an idea in another person, and then you guys just tussle back and forth really well, which makes for a really engaging podcast. And if anyone is really loves what you're saying, and they've worked out that you guys being from like an engineer background can really translate super effectively into a performance-based topic, then they will love the Endurance Innovation Podcast. And so once again, thanks guys for coming on and sharing your wisdom.
Thanks so much. It's been a ton of fun.
Yeah, thanks, Brody. We obviously love talking about it, and any opportunity that we get, we'll turn one sentence into four.
Thanks once again for listening. To take full advantage of the knowledge you are building, you need to download the Run Smarter app. This contains all of my free access podcast episodes, written blogs, and ebooks, along with my paid video courses, all neatly housed into categories for you to easily navigate through and find content you're interested in. Also, be sure to check out the show notes for links to the podcast Facebook group and links to learn more about becoming a podcast patron. Who contribute $5 per month to get Inner Circle VIP access, including an invitation into the exclusive patron Facebook group and a complete back catalogue of patron-only podcast episodes, which you can access within the app. Also on the app, you can even find a link that takes you to my online physio clinic, where I assess and treat runners from all over the world, so I can be on standby if you ever need one-on-one physiotherapy assistance. Once again, thank you for listening and becoming a Run Smarter Scholar. And remember, knowledge is power.